Hi, I'm Rob Grizz and I'm the producer of Australian Rock of Ages, and it's a pleasure to bring you another program in this series of 24 monthly programs that will feature the life and time stories of some of the people whose talent, skills and dedication have contributed to the development of Australian music, particularly through the 1960s and 1970s. In this program, we feature the story of Phil Manning.
My father was in Melbourne and he tried to talk me into going back to Tasmania. And I'd read that the Bay City Union were looking for a guitar player, and I'd written down their address. And I'd met them prior to that in Brisbane when I was with Tony Worsley. And so I said, I've got a job, Dad. I hadn't. I was just bluffing. I didn't want to go back to Tasmania. And Dad said, oh, we'll get a cab out there. So I had my guitar and my bag. And we pulled up there, and I said, wait here, Dad. And I went inside, knocked on the door, and Glenn Wheatley answered it. Mm-hmm. And I said, hi, Glenn. That, we'd met each other. I said, you're looking for a guitar player? And he said, yeah. I said, hang on, I'll get my bags. And so I go and get my bags and say, it's okay, Dad, I got it, it's cool. And at the same time, Glenn's running down to Matt's flat saying, Matt, you know that blonde guitar player from Tony Worsley? Yeah, he's just joined the band. And Matt said, oh, I seem to remember he was pretty good. We'll give it a try anyway. So that's how Matt Taylor and I...
That's how you connected.
That's how we connected, yeah.
And that became a very strong bond between both of you, didn't it, that relationship?
Yeah, well, you know, it's been on and off. We've had our ups and downs, you know.
It's like a marriage, isn't it?
But... you know, it's certainly, as we've got older, it's been really sort of stable and really strong. You know, because I'd consider Matt probably absolutely my best friend. You know,
yeah,
and we work well together.
So the gig that resulted from your meeting up with Matt, how long did that band stay together?
Look, I get confused with it all.
I understand that one.
You know,
the dates and things just miss.
Yeah, because we were sort of living in a world of there's no time. It was just get up in the morning and go to bed sometime later. You know, and
that's right.
And repeat it. And of course, our weekends tended to be when we worked, so everything was upside down. But I think I stayed in the Bay City Union for about 6 months. Then I worked with Laurie Allen Review for about 6 weeks. And then I got asked to go to Perth to join the Beaten Tracks, which eventually came back to Melbourne, got Wendy Saddington as our singer, and renamed the band Chain.
So that's how Chain started.
About October of 1968.
You were based in Melbourne for quite a while, weren't you?
Well, yeah, a while, but then we moved to Sydney.
Why was that, given that in that period Melbourne had most of the really hot venues? Why was the move to Sydney?
I think it was a lot to do with management, and there were things that were changing, right? There was stuff that was changing at the time, and what Sydney offered at the time that Melbourne didn't have was residencies, where you could go and play at, say, Caesars, because there were a couple of Caesars places, and there was the Here discotheque on the North Shore, and you could go in there and do seasons. So you might do, like for instance, we might do a week at one of the Caesars places, and then the next week we'd do the other one. And then we might do, you know, a short stint at somewhere else. Like there was the Whiskey A Go-Go. As well as that, there were a lot of big suburban dances. You had access to Newcastle. And there was a place at Newcastle called... I can't remember the name.
That's how we just keep it in Newcastle. Well, yeah.
Anyway, there was another place up there that you could go up and do three or four nights in a row. So that really suited us at the time.
Mm.
And also there was the record label was there, Festival.
True. Yes, you know? Yes.
So we sort of based ourselves there for a while, but Chain went through a lot of different lineups. And after the Windy Saddington lineup, we had a couple of lineup changes. But then I decided to come back to Melbourne to join Barry Sullivan and Barry Harvey.
Mm-hmm.
Warren said, "I'm coming with you." This is what Warren Morgan mm-hmm. was the piano mm-hmm. player by then. Glyn Mason we got a bit later, but we moved back to Melbourne. And then that band itself moved to Sydney for a while. And then after Warren joined the Aztecs, Glyn went to England. That left Barry Sullivan, Barry Harvey and myself. We went to Brisbane, where Barry and Barry's parents lived,
mm-hmm.
stayed with them for a while. And Matt Taylor tried to get me to join a band of his in Melbourne, but I got back to him and said, "No, you come up to Brisbane and join Chain."
Right.
So Matt went to Brisbane, joined Chain, and he said, "I've got this guy, young guy in Melbourne that would like to manage us. I think he'd be really good for us. His name's Michael Gadinski." And so we came back to Melbourne after a short time, and we recorded Black and Blue on the way through Sydney.
You work me so hard that my back's near broke. My brow is wet and my throat's a choke. You send me hell for 10 long years. I miss my whiskey and I miss my beer. Ain't seen a gal since I don't know when. And the way you treat me won't see one again.
So then Michael basically took over the management of the band when we got back to Melbourne, and it wasn't long before we had a number one.
That's right.
It was amazing.
It was. It was amazing because the style of music you were playing would not have been considered as pop music by any stretch of the imagination.
Oh, it was a dirge.
Well, I wouldn't have quite called it that. To have been successful live is one thing, but to actually get a hit as well, that was really quite an achievement.
Yeah, well, it was an achievement. I think it was probably more an achievement for Michael Gadinski than it was for us, because we worked out how it happened.
Ah, please share.
What happened was, this is why Michael's a manager, obviously. Michael would run dances, right? And he'd put Chain on as the headliner at the dance with a couple of support acts. You'd have to pay $1.80 or $1.50 to get in, but you'd be given a free copy of the Chain single, which at the time, I think the singles were about 75 cents or 80 cents or something like that. So Michael would go out around the record shops and buy up all the Black and Blues and then give them away as part of the door price. And so the radio stations were forced to play the record because it was on the charts.
Of course.
And then once that started getting played, it had its own momentum.
That's right. Nothing succeeds like success.
Yeah, yeah.
That's right. So you've got this loop going then.
Yeah. That's exactly what happened. And I don't think Matt and I, we were too stoned at the time to take much notice of anything, but it was years later, and someone put a poster up on the web quite a few years ago now, and I was looking at it, and a penny dropped. There, down the bottom, it's got entry, $1.50, includes Chain's latest single, Black and Blue.
Look, there's many things can be said about Michael, but one thing that I think most people agree on is that he had the smarts. He knew what he was doing.
Yeah, you know, I mean, but, you know, like Michael's had his downs as well.
Oh, definitely.
It hasn't been all up for Michael, you know. There are a couple of times back in the sort of 70s, or the late 70s, early 80s, where he got pretty close to going under, and... but, you know, he's done really well, and he's a very respected figure in the music scene.
Well, there's no doubt about it. I think it would have been completely different if Kandinsky hadn't happened.
Oh, I mean,
He created quite a bit of the scene at that time.
Well, I think both Matt and I hold Michael in very high esteem, because Michael really was very, very much a part of giving us our careers. Once you've had some big chart success and you've been at the top, you know, my name became a very well-known name. If Black and Blue hadn't happened and if we hadn't had Judgment and Toward the Blues, I wouldn't have had anything like the reputation or the name that I got, which has sort of sustained me through the years.
Now, I don't know if this is an unfair question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Given the success you had at that period, is that the lineup of Chain that you feel for yourself was the one you enjoyed most?
No, not at all. I enjoyed all the Chains, some more so than others. And there were aspects of the Chain that I really didn't like. One of the things that happened with the Black and Blue Chain, which was only together in its pure form for 11 months, one of the things about that was we worked so hard, we were doing so much live work and touring, that it sort of burnt out the creative spark, as it were. There's a certain tension that happens between Matt and I, in that I tend to be a bit of a... I tend to push the timing. Matt tends to lay back on it. And so Matt and I working together is really quite... I can even recognise it myself that it's quite magic, because there's a tension thing that happens.
Mm.
And that sort of dynamic only existed in the Black and Blue Chain. The Black and Blue Chain was a very stoned one. I mean, most Chain's lineups were very stoned, but that one particularly. And having Matt in the band put a whole different edge to it, because it went, you know, for, well, big harmonica sound, big vocal sound. And we tended to play a lot more laid back, and so a lot more bluesy.
Mm.
And on the other hand, there's real aspects of all the Chains that were fun, you know, that it still is a fun band, you know. We don't get together that often nowadays, but when we do, it's fantastic.
Well, for people listening, when you say we don't get together that often now, when was the last time you got together?
We got together at the beginning of November for the Early Beach Music Festival. We just did one night up there.
Do you find you have got to do any preparation, or does it just come easy?
Yeah, we've got to do preparation. I mean, we generally speaking, when we are going to do a series of shows, we'll talk beforehand on the phone and decide what songs we're going to do. So then we'll listen to them and And then we'll have at least one rehearsal to just tidy up the arrangements, or, you know, because quite often we'll get together and we'll say, oh, listen, I'm sick to death of that beginning. You know, I'd really like to change the end of that. Or, you know, or else something might happen by accident and we'll go, oh, listen, let's keep that, you know. So it's very important that we do have, you know, at least a run through. We've sort of noticed that when we've just gone out cold, what seems to happen is the first night will be really great and we'll go, gee, that was mighty. And then the second night will be shocking. We'll just forget everything. Don't know why that is, but it's happened in the past too many times. So now we always get together and have a rehearsal.
Most of us who came up through that generation are familiar with Chain and feel like it's ours. You know, it's a group that's seems like it's always been around, and it's comfortable and it's lovely. And I think knowing that it still plays brings a degree of comfort for a lot of people that like you and Matt and the others. You know, as people, and as individuals, and as a group. For yourself, how hard was it to move away from Chain after the big period was over?
Well, it was difficult financially, more so than any other way, because one of the things that happened during Chain's big period there, I became incredibly frustrated creatively. I had all these fantastic acoustic ideas, and I was playing most of the day, writing, you know, and I had nowhere for it to go. And because Chain had sort of was overworked at the stage, not many of my ideas got through. And I guess, you know, Matt to some degree would have been in the same boat too, because he was at that stage starting to write things like I remember when I was young and stuff. So when I finally left Chain in 1974, well, I had a couple of little bands, the Band of Talabini and Willie and the Philtones, and I worked with Brian Cadd's Bootleg Family for a while. I tried some solo stuff, but that was really hard to do at the time, because the pop world was getting heavier and heavier.
Of course, that's right.
And louder, and it had moved into pubs. So instead of having attentive audiences, you know, you had rowdy drunks wanting to dance on the tables. And
So the music was transitioning at that period. You know, we were moving into the 80s and it was all becoming a little bit more techno-directed. How did that affect you? Did you find that difficult to cope with, or did you just follow your path and ignore what was happening around you?
Well, I was still working pretty solidly about that time. I had a manager who ran me into a lot of debt in the late 70s, and I escaped to Tasmania and rented a farm for about 10 months and went hunting every day, and sort of went bush, really, until I figured on how to sort of get back. It took me about 5 years to pay all the creditors off, but I eventually did, which had its upside, because it ended up giving me an A-grade credit rating. And so anyway, I came back to Melbourne and I went across to work with Matt Taylor for about a year in Western Australia with the Matt Taylor Phil Manning Oz Blues Band. We did one album, Oz Blues. We toured a lot, but then I came back to Melbourne and started up a Phil Manning Band. And that went through quite a few lineups over the next couple of years. And then I ran into my third wife. I ended up moving up to Tamarind Mountain in Queensland, where I was for about 15 years.
I hope you'll join Phil and myself next week for the final part of his story, which not only continues the story of his solo career, but it's where Phil shares his thoughts and his concerns on a number of important social issues. Next week, part 3, the final part of the life and times of Phil Manning. We'll go out now with a piece by Phil Manning and Matt Taylor from 1981 called Coming On Strong.
This program is a Handsome Dog production and is podcast through the Toorak Times and TAG.